Hello, I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.04.00. This podcast is being published on Sunday, March 14, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio4.net. That's radio4. ALL.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and Anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio4ALL.net and Anchor.fm. Today's episode title is George Floyd, January the 6th and GameStop. There is a connection between the three disconnected events. Now, on with the episode.
And now, the definition.
And our next guest is one of my favorite journalists on technology and related issues, and he has a new book on the subject. Yasha Levine is the author of the new book, which I am holding in my hands, Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. He joins us now. Welcome, Yasha.
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks for writing this book, which I consider a very valuable addition to the literature of technology and modern society, and that's saying a lot. Let's start with, I guess, the obvious question. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, you know, it came out of reporting that I was doing on Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley's for-profit surveillance businesses. I came to see it. You know, a lot of these companies that we use every day, like Google and Facebook, I mean, the lifeblood of their business, really the thing that fuels them, is surveillance, right? They make money off targeted advertising. And to make sure that they customize the ads that we see, they want to know us as intimately as possible, right? And so to do that, they collect everything about us, you know, everything that they can, they grab and try to analyze in order to make money. And so when I started digging into this business, I began to realize that what these companies were doing was really not that much different or any different than what the NSA, you know, wants to do with the world, or what the military wants to do with the world. They want to, you know, watch everybody. They want to understand everything. They want to have a kind of total information awareness about the world. And as I got deeper into looking at the symbiotic relationship between the military and Silicon Valley, I also began to understand that surveillance was something that was very intrinsically part of the structure of the internet and the structure of computer technology in general. And I went down this path that led me to discover a hidden history of the internet, a forgotten history about the internet as a surveillance tool, that it was designed to be a surveillance tool from the very beginning. Which, you know, when I got into that history, I began to realize that it's the history of the internet is darker than we've been led to believe, and because we've been told a lot of myths about the internet and we've believed them. You know, we've heard a lot about the utopian nature of the technology,
right. And
the democratic nature of the technology and all these things, but it's darker, and it's very much tied to surveillance and control. Going back, like, you know, half a century.
And the myths we're usually told about the internet, or the story we've been led to believe, Yasha Levine, is that, you know, it was invented basically by benevolent California hippies in the 70s and 80s, and they took something that scientists were tinkering with, maybe people know it was associated with the research arm of the Pentagon, but they took this thing and they wanted everybody to have information and information to be free. And then some business people came in and said, let's monetize this. But what your book says to me, based on my understanding of it, is no, actually the surveillance dimension, the kind of panopticon, or, you know, the semi, with all the sinister overtones that the word surveillance has, that really is, has been part of the technology, the internet, from the very from its dawn, from its inception. Is that basically right?
Yes, that's the thesis of my book. And look, I mean, there were some people who worked on the ARPANET in the Bay Area who took acid, you know, and they smoked pot and they went to Grateful Dead shows. I mean, that is true, right? But and at the same time, they were military contractors, right? And so these two things are not mutually exclusive, especially given, you know, the times. But these guys that were thinking about technology, maybe some in a utopian sense, right? They were still working for the military, and they were military contractors, and they were not funding the technology. They were not, you know, arguing for why this technology is necessary. They were the ones who were building it, who were contracted to build it. And so, if you to understand where the internet really came out of, you have to go back to the beginning, to go back to the 1960s, and you know, back then America was this, expanding global power, a new global power still, and it was facing insurgencies all around the world. It was facing the war in Vietnam, but also conflicts from Latin America to Southeast Asia, and it was also facing, of course, a turbulent domestic situation with anti-war protests, civil rights movements, bombings that were going off almost every day by the Weather Underground. And at the time, in certain military circles, it was believed that America was facing a new kind of threat at the time. It was a new kind of war. It was a global insurgency underwritten by the Soviet Union that was working, you know, to expand globally but also undermine America domestically. And so this new kind of war could not be fought with traditional armies like tanks, or, you know, you couldn't drop a nuke on it to solve the problem, although a lot of people wanted to do that because the civilian, the combatant wasn't wearing, you know, army fatigues. He wasn't marching in formation. He was part of the civilian population. And so the question was, how do you find the enemy within, right? Whether it's in America or whether it's in, you know, rebellious tribes in northern Thailand, right? How do you find out who's rebellious and why? And how do you predict, you know, who will rebel next? And so the idea was that for this new kind of war, you needed a new kind of information weapon, right? You needed tools that could ingest a lot of data, process it, data on people, you know, like welfare rolls, criminal histories, economic data on societies that could, you know, that could predict maybe where there would be some kind of strife, or where there would be economic problems, you know, so you could put all that together, analyze it in complex ways, and run it through predictive models, and then hopefully you would have the system that could find the enemy from within, I mean, find the enemy that's hidden in civilian populations and eradicate it, right? And so that's where the internet came out of. I mean,
so,
that's what ARPA...
Yeah, just to step in for a second, so are you saying that at some point as far back as the 1960s, somebody actually said, or some group of people in the U.S. military actually said, it would be great to have a tool that kind of monitors what people are doing and thinking so that we can spot the troublemakers early?
Yes.
Yeah, and what was that? Was that like a series of research papers, or?
I mean, it came from all sorts of, it was in the air. It was so obvious to people, because you have to understand that a lot of people who were working on the ARPANET, the network that became the internet, came out of, cut their teeth on SAGE, which SAGE was the first radar defense system that America built, starting in the 1950s, to protect America from nuclear attack by air, right? So it could track hostile aircraft and then intercept them with missiles if they were deemed to be hostile. Now, that system was, you know, the first national kind of computer network system, because it had radar installations, you know, on the borders and in off the coasts, right? And those things fed into these big IBM computers, and, you know, then that information was fed into these workstations where Air Force analysts would be sitting there and monitoring radar defense. And so it was the first computerized surveillance system, you know, surveillance writ large, because you could track things in the real world, right? Use computer system to track things. And it was, at the time, it was a pretty obvious extension. It's like, if you can do this for aircraft, right? If you can monitor the world for hostile aircraft and figure out, oh, okay, is this hostile or not hostile? If it's hostile, okay, where is it going? How can we intercept it, right? So you can almost predict their behavior into the future, right? Looking at their trajectory. So why can't you do that for people, right? That was a pretty obvious leap. And so there were a lot of symposiums at the time that were talking about how to deal with counterinsurgency, right? And there are a lot of projects, not just in ARPA, which was, you know, now we know it as DARPA, it's the R&D wing of the Pentagon, but the U.S. Army was also carrying out a lot of research in sort of predictive systems for human behavior that it was trying to deploy in Latin America. It wasn't like something that was hidden. It was something that was in the air, right? As the way that people talk about big data now is how back then in the 1960s, people talked about sort of predicting, using computer technology to predict future events and predict people's behavior. And I'd like to just point out that while we have lost that aspect of our history or the history of the network and network technology, back then people understood what this technology was about. Going back to as early as 1969, which is the first year that the ARPANET was turned on. So the ARPANET was turned on in 1969. That same year, there was huge protest in MIT against the ARPANET. And there were these pamphlets and booklets passed out on campus talking about the ARPANET as the beginning of this surveillance network that was going to allow what they called Washington's policemen to better manage the world and to control the world. And so it was obvious to people almost half a century ago what this network was, and we've sort of lost it. You know, it had been really successfully rebranded starting in the 1980s and 1990s into something utopian, whereas it wasn't that before.
That's really interesting because, you know, I'm old enough to remember. I was a kid, but I'm old enough to remember those days. And if you went to the World's Fair or whatever, you would always see, you know, the wired home of the future, the connected home of the future. And you could press a button and talk to your cousin in Cincinnati or whatever, and you'd see their picture on a screen. So I guess it was a logical extension to say, yeah, and we could covertly track all of this too. So let's flash forward to the 80s, and this starts to get modeled as a utopian hippie vision. And not long after that, gets privatized. And you mentioned, I think it's Stephen Wolf, who, you know, agrees that he might be called the guy who privatized the internet. So it gets idealized and then it gets privatized. And in this process, what we forget its military origins, and the private sector does the military's work for us. Like, take us through that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting history, right? Because I think some people are aware, a lot of people just don't have no clue about where the internet came from. You know, it just sort of magically appeared in the 90s, right? And but, you know, if people do have a sense of where it came from, there is a sense that, oh, yes, it came out of the Pentagon like a long, long time ago. But of course, it's no longer tied to the Pentagon in any way. But there's this, you know, black hole that we have between the 90s and sort of the 70s and the 60s when the internet first was developed, right? Like, what happened in those two decades? And, you know, what astounded me as I started really getting deep into the history of the internet is how little we understand about how the internet was privatized. You know, the internet is arguably the most valuable invention of the 20th century, right? I mean, it's underlies society right now. There's no part of our life that it doesn't touch any, right? And it's created these mega billionaires who are like our overlords now, who see everything about us and make so much money. It's unfathomable to us and have so much power over our political process. You know, these people were created out of this system, right? Out of this telecommunication system. And the system was explicitly privatized by the federal government starting in the mid-80s and concluding in like 1994. And there were, you know, bureaucrats that were working for the National Science Foundation, that this is where the privatization took place. And there are people who literally privatized the internet. I mean, they privatized the internet, and we don't know about them. We don't know their names. So I was born in the Soviet Union, right? And everyone in Russia today knows the people who privatized their country. You know, they might not know the details of what happened or how it happened, but they know the names. They know some names, and they can put a face to it, right? And they don't like them usually. They're not revered in the country. But in America, we don't know who privatized the internet, such a vital and important part of our society today, right? And so I uncover that, and it's a really fascinating story. It's depressing, because it shows how easily you could privatize something so valuable and without anyone really raising alarm or even knowing it was happening, because at the time people weren't aware of the internet really. It was just starting to come out of academia. It was just starting to come into people's homes because you needed cheap computers in order to connect to the internet. And so you needed the personal computer revolution to first take hold, right? So people could actually own computers in their home, and it wasn't just connected to their business or to their academic institution. And so it's a really dark story, I think, because it just shows how easily you can be swindled. And then, of course, that history gets erased because, history is always written by the victors, right? Or so the saying goes. And so the victors are Sergey Brin. They are Silicon Valley oligarchs. And so the history that they wrote for us does not include any of that.
Right. And I think that's very true. And I think, I mean, there are multiple dimensions to it. There's the argument, I think, legitimately to be made that this is a public convention that's been taken for private gain. In that sense, the parallel with the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe is really apt. And there's also the military nature of it and the ongoing threat that poses to our civil liberties. And I guess in the last few seconds we have, Yasha Levine, what would you want people to know about this book?
Well, you know, I think this book is important because in order for us to try to take democratic control over the internet, which is something very important, something we absolutely have to do, and take democratic control not over just the internet, but of technology in general, and try to guide how technology affects our life and our society. We have to do that. We have to know the history of this technology, and so we can't operate based on our sort of utopian myths that we've been fed. We have to look at the dark and sometimes depressing and aspect of where this technology came from. Because if we don't understand it, we can't have a handle on it, and we can't have a handle on it to do anything about it. So we have to, recovering our history, our collective history is extremely important for the future.
Well, and I think that is very well said, and I think the book is extremely well written. Again, the book is Surveillance Valley, The Secret Military History of the Internet. Yasha Levine, thanks for writing it. Thanks for joining.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. And you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. It's your brother, Brian Matthews. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield Podcast segment. In the last 6 months, you've had three events that I believe are actually connected. One occurring under Trump, even though it was an extension of really what had been evolving over the previous 6 years. And two so far sort of taking place under Biden. I mean, the one kind of straddles. George Floyd, you had the death of him and the protests that resulted from that, which we have forgotten what followed those protests. It's frightening, in fact. Then you obviously had January 6th. It's funny, I don't even have to put any descriptive after that. That is how synonymous January 6th is now. You had January 6th. And then you have GameStop, or the Reddit users bidding up the GameStop stock. Well, I believe these three are very much connected. In the wake of George Floyd's death, the protests that resulted across the country did not go unnoticed. Many of us forget, but undercover police officers, the DOH, the Pentagon even, deployed assets throughout the domestic field, as it might be called if we were talking about war, in order to not only monitor the protests, but to gain intel on them. And here what I'm talking about, again, we forget this. I mean, there's obviously there's been a lot that's happened in the last year, so understandably so. But we forget this. What I'm talking about here is the DOD, along with DHS, literally deployed assets throughout the country to take photographs of the protests, to identify the ringleaders, to identify the most boisterous, to identify those who might be corrupted, to identify those who needed to be corrupted. The ones who might be corrupted are those who the DOD and the DHS might pay to become assets, informants within the community, or even influencers within the community. The other ones that needed to be corrupted are those who obviously have fire in their belly and influence within the community, individuals that if they were to get the spark of consciousness, they could lead people towards a vision. These people are determined to be too dangerous not to be corrupted, not to be brought into the fold. Or at least they are potential, they are labeled with I don't want to say labeled with, but they are there is attached to them a label of potential dangerousness, because the promise of a, what did the FBI call it back in 1966? Oh yes, a black messiah is seen on them. So these people needed to be corrupted. They need to be folded in to the power structure somehow, some way, to stop them from actually having a vision that would liberate their people. This is what the DOD and the like was doing. They literally were flying drones above these protests and taking pictures where this, and by the way, this information, if you care to look it up, it is completely out there from legitimate sources that you might call authoritative sources. These things were happening. They were taking these photographs and then they were running them through facial recognition data, so they could try to identify these people not only through, you know, during their day-to-day life, but they wanted to be able to identify any profiles they had on the internet, any social media content that they were posting, things like that. And they started building profiles of these people. Oh, yeah. People forget about this, but this indeed happened. Black Lives Matter was treated as a domestic terrorist threat. This obviously is an extension of the idea of the black identity extremist idea that had been floated by the Justice Department back in 2017, which, you know, it didn't even occur to me that early in the Obama administration, the first term of Obama, they actually had written a similar warning about white identity extremists. And because white identity extremists are typically right-wing, Don't forget about the typically. They usually are all white, right-wing. Conservatives went crazy. Conservatives went crazy. So they actually walked that back and dismantled the domestic unit that was in charge of that. And I think, God, who did I see this guy on? I've inhaled too much media recently, so I apologize. But I actually saw an interview with him, and it was quite good. I think it was Tom Hartman, if I remember correctly. But anyway, they were treated like terrorists. And right now, I am confident in the FBI, in DHS, they have profiles of hundreds, if not thousands, of leftist activists who were at these protests, and they have started to move towards trying to corrupt as many of those they deem as potentially liberationists as they could. This has been what they've done since the 60s. So why change up the book? Now, fast forward to Jan 6, and you see some of the same tactics unfolding. It's quite interesting. It's quite interesting. It's literally about 6 months apart. The height of the George Floyd protest was about the 6th of June. And then you had, on January 6th, who would have thunk it back then, but you had on January 6th, the storming of the Capitol. The same technologies that right-wingers were applauding, they were applauding across the board. Right-wingers were applauding across the board. Yay, get those N-words. Get those, oh yeah, I forgot, they don't say N-words. Get those criminals. Get those dog whistling racist names that I don't like because they're really black. They were celebrating it. They were calling them thugs and criminals and all kinds of other nonsensical words. They were celebrating it. And now it's a police state when it's executed against them. But I don't want to lose my focus here, because there's something that happened Jan 6 that I don't believe we saw as much on during the George Floyd protests, which is kind of 1984 scary. And I'm serious, it's like a 1984 level scary. In the George Floyd protests, you know, you didn't have a lot of people dropping dimes on other people. Or at least it doesn't appear to have happened. It wasn't flaunted. For those of you not old enough, dropping a dime references the idea that a person back in the 70s and 80s, but also the 70s, and I think even the 60s, they would go to a payphone, drop in a dime, and call up the police station and say, I know you're looking for so-and-so. Here's where you can find them, and hang up. That's dropping a dime. That didn't happen with the George Floyd protests. But with the Jan 6th, you literally see people calling the state on their loved ones. This was literally something that happened in 1984. I'm not saying that some of these people don't need to be punished. I'm saying that that's kind of frightening. That's kind of frightening. Now, the similarities between the surveillance used with BLM and the surveillance used with the Jan 6, what they call insurrectionists, is huge. You have facial recognition software, you have pinging to cell phones. They were using the same thing, except it's kind of funny. They were using the same thing with BLM, but they were also, in many instances, scrambling the area, so you couldn't send videos out, you couldn't send messages or anything like that. They literally treated these people like it was a war zone, like they were a real threat to national security. They did not do the same thing for the Capitol, which shows you the difference, but it also shows you the similarities. It has always been my belief, because reading through older books, I see this great continuity in the fact that right-wingers are treated as patriots, they're treated as platform-worthy. And so, it has been my belief that the right-wingers are seen as the real Americans. The BLM protesters are not. But with the facial recognition software that was used with BLM being used on the Jan 6 insurrectionists, if that's what you want to call them, they've also done the same thing. But I don't know if they're doing it to the extent that they did for the BLM. They've gone online, looked up these people's profiles, using facial recognition. They were able to literally scrub the internet using facial recognition, I want to call it handwriting analysis, but it's not handwriting analysis. When people type, they have a specific manner in which they construct their sentences, and it's pretty unique person to person. And so, the more educated you are, the more likely it is that you're going to, craft it in this way or that way. But still, there is a writing style, typically, and especially the more not educated you are, the more likely it is that you have a more unique writing style. And there's software that can help you literally look for that. There's software. So, I mean, this is Orwellian, is what I'm trying to get across here. But then when you jump forward to GameStop, and by the way, when it comes to Jan 6, you see a lot of people getting fired. You see a lot of people losing their livelihoods. You see a lot of people getting deplatformed. This is massive censorship. Massive censorship. I don't even believe the stuff that these people are talking about. And I know how dangerous these people can be. I do. I'm going through the book. I'm listening to the book at work right now called Rule and Ruin. And what is evident about these authoritarian right-wingers is that what they do is they'll ask for sympathy and the full extent of the law, of the full extent of the spiritual concept in the law to be afforded to them. And then when they reach their benchmark, when they reach their goal, they will not extend that same spiritual law to the other person because they've gained what they wanted. These people are a physical danger to me and to my loved ones and to this country. But I do know that is still, that deplatforming is dangerous. And now we go to GameStop. And we go to what has brought a lot of joy to me over the last couple of days. And I look at what has been done with GameStop. I look at what has occurred with the censorship on Reddit, with the deplatforming for a while on Discord, with the shutting down of websites, with literally the elite getting together and saying, we need to stop this. We need to put a hold to this. We need to put regulation on the books to stop these ordinary people from doing what we're doing. And that's the key, ladies and gentlemen. We have seen three incarnations of the contempt that the elite has for the ordinary person, We have seen this. We have seen this. With Black Lives Matter, they couldn't come out and bust people's heads deliberately. So what they did was they gathered information. So after the cameras are gone, 6, 7, 8 months, 10 months, 12 months down the road, which is what they're proving with the Jan 6, people thought they had gotten away. No, no. Washington, D.C. pegged their phones, gained their information, and then waited until they went home and started getting them. This is the same thing that was done in Baltimore, the same thing that was done in Ferguson. It is the same thing that will be done throughout the country when you are talking about these protests that came out of George Floyd. They're going to wait several months, maybe even a year or more, and then they're going to come at these people when they have charges that they think could stick. When it comes to GameStop, they are literally showing you that there is two sets of laws for us and them. This is a country, this occurred to me the other day when I was listening to this. The Founding Fathers, to the extent that they were, said that they worried about this becoming a nation of men rather than a nation of laws. Well, congratulations, ladies and gentlemen. We are kind of a nation of laws, but there are two laws. And again, this comes from Rome. In Rome, there were always two laws. I don't understand why people act like Rome did not have two sets of laws. There were laws for the citizens, and there was laws for the non-citizens. And increasingly, it is evident that the wealthy of this country view themselves as being the citizens of this country. That the rest of us, we are just consumers. We are second tier. And then there's the caste whole thing that I've talked to you about. But we are second tier. And I think we need to get this through our minds. What they literally just did, and if you think about what was done in Occupy Wall Street, when people started going to banks to take their money out, and they would go to the big banks to take their money out, to put it into credit unions. What were they told? They were locked, the one I think was in Texas, they were locked in and they were told what? You cannot be a protester and a customer at the same time. That's what they were told. And you know what these wealthy people are doing right now to Reddit? They're telling Reddit, the Reddit users that did this. Because the Reddit users, let's be very frank, ladies and gentlemen, the speculators were trying to speculate GameStop into non-existence. The Reddit users liked GameStop, so they bet it up because they wanted it. And that's supposed to be how the market works. What these people are telling them is, you are consumers and you are not in a position to be protesters. They protested with their money. They protested with their ingenuity, their know-how. And the wealthy just said, you cannot be a customer in a protester at the same time, you damn serfs. Get back to your position. You are not us. We are the citizens. We are the ones who rule this. We are the ones who run this. And you better recognize that. Because if you don't, well, look at who has all the power. We'll deplatform you. We'll make sure that you can't have as much fun as you had before. When I saw the CEO of Robinhood talking, I recognized just how screwed this system was. Because they really do look at us as cash cows. We are only supposed to be here for their enjoyment, their benefit. You know, a lot of us are just financial concubines for them. They come, they take what they want, and that's it. We have no say in it. We just hand over to them what they want, and that's the end of the day. I mean, ladies and gentlemen, the amount of, and I know I just got off on a tangent, sorry, had to go there, but the amount of deplatforming that has taken place based on this, the constrictions that are put around these people because they defied the wealthy, and then the condescending, spit-in-the-face language that is being used on these uppity, hoity-toity CNBC, Fox Business News and the like, TV shows. I mean, even Jim Cramer understands. Like Sagar and Jetty said, when I have to join Jim Cramer and say, yeah, whoa. And by the way, it feels good to agree with Sagar on something because I typically, especially when he gets going into the, quote, cultural conservative stuff, can't do it. The man is good for some things, and this he's very forthright on this stuff. But this is dangerous, ladies and gentlemen. This is dangerous. This reveals to you what capitalism is completely about. I heard Crystal Ball talk about I believe she was talking about, I can't even think of how she worded it. But she was talking about what the Clintons did to kind of deregulate everything. And I want to say that she was talking about the financialization of the markets. But this goes back to the 70s, and really much longer if you read Goliath, Matt Stoller's brilliant book. But she's right. This thing has been completely rigged over the last 30 years to benefit wealthy people. And now that ordinary people just said, whoa, we are protecting something that we like. We're not allowing you to drive this thing into the ground. We're stopping you from doing what you've done to our communities. Now there's a problem. Now the people who have been yelling about, oh, we need to let the free market work. We need to let the market do what the market's supposed to do. Ladies and gentlemen, knock on your head right now. Wake up. Do you not see what the market is? Do you not see what the market is? The market, when they talk about the free market, what they're talking about is free rich people to do whatever they want. The market is rich people. That's what it is. The invisible hand of the market is a bunch of rich people making decisions about money. That's what it is. These people just literally tripped over 2020, fell into 2021, busted open their heads and allowed you to see their brains. What do I mean? I mean, these people so filled with hubris. Because while the rest of the United States is tanking, we are in a depression, ladies and gentlemen. This country is in a depression. While the whole country is tanking, the stock market is doing just fine. These people are filled with the brilliance of their own magnificence. And that caused them to get sloppy. Because they thought they were going to take down GameStop to make billions, put people out of work, kill another brick and mortar store, which then would hurt local communities. And they were running forward to do that too. They were running forward to destroy that company. And they slipped up and they tripped. Because they let their game plan be known. And they let their game plan be known by simply doing it. Somebody on Reddit said, oh, I've seen this game before. Hey, you guys, check this out. They're trying to really do this, and we don't... No. We love GameStop. Let's stop these mofos right here. And they slipped up, and they tripped, and they fell over, and you know what? You seen that head split wide open, and suddenly you saw in the brains how everything works. How government really is there, not for you and me, but for them. This is why, ladies and gentlemen, there's a connection here between Wall Street and Joe Biden's pathetic $1.9 trillion stimulus package. And yes, it's pathetic, ladies and gentlemen, it's pathetic. To do what Joe Biden is talking about doing in that stimulus package, the Democrats passed a $3.3 trillion package back in April, May, for the same purposes. And that was supposed to only get us to the end of the year, about 8 months. Joe Biden is asking us to believe that $1.9 trillion is going to get us from March to September, October, when hopefully we'll be able to start going out and acting a little normal. Well, what if there's another variant that comes along and completely hammers us in the world again? Which was likely to happen. And I'm talking in October, November, December, which is when it would start to appear. Well, that means, oh my, we're going to have to go back into lockdown. $1.9 trillion is nothing. You need at least two times that. But we're acting like we don't. And it's because the stock market's doing so good. It's because the stock market is doing so good. The stock market is doing so good because it's based on false wealth. Lee Kemp did this in just absolutely amazing, amazing piece on how the stock market is absolutely fictitious. It doesn't even create real wealth. All of these people who are running around talking about they're the wealthiest this, they're the wealthiest that, they're the wealthiest this, they're the wealthiest that. Ladies and gentlemen, that's on paper. They don't actually own that money. A lot of the stock market is built on quicksand. It's not real. And what you're seeing now is how that is done. The reason why all these people jumped in, let's be frank about this. The reason why all these people are jumping in now, is because so many of these people have tied their wealth, their real wealth, which isn't much, to the false wealth of the market, that if what the Redditors did caught on, and ordinary people started actually playing the stock market how the wealthy play it, you would see trillions of dollars siphoned off into the pocket of the everyday man, woman, and child. And they don't want that. They don't want that. Now, here's the thing. I had a flash of inspiration when I was watching this unfold. Back to the 1920s, when yes, everybody and their mama was trading, and at the end of the decade, there was the crash. And I was thinking, oh crap, are we about to do this again? I don't know. But I will say this. They have been playing games for the longest time with everyone's money, and it's only been benefiting them. It's only been benefiting them. It's time. It is time to change that. It's time to change that. And they know it's time to change that. They know. They know. They have security details and stuff. Look, ladies and gentlemen, here's the thing. These people have done their research. A lot of these big wealthy firms and what have you, they do these great data dives onto the internet to see where people's minds are at, to see what things are flowing, what things are not. And, you know, not all of them do it, but a lot of the bigger ones do. And they know that social discontentment is forget about on the rise. If we were measuring it like we do the daily cases of COVID-19, you'd look at a graph, 0 to, let's say, 500,000. You know, for a long time, discontentment was, it was pretty high. It was, maybe 40, 50,000. But over the last year, it's gone from probably, 102,000, 105,000, to now you're up to probably about 360,000 to 400,000. People are not happy with what's been happening with the stock market, especially as they see their community dying. Joe Biden said something like 1 in 6 small businesses are going to, go out of business or something like that. Absolute bullocks. Nonsense. Nonsense. The number is going to be much greater than that. And you can tell by the fact that there are so many people going to food closets throughout the country. See, this is something that the news refuses to talk about. This is something that the news refuses to talk about. You literally have thousands of people in each state going to food closets to get food because they're food insecure. And I know Joe Biden signed some he signed an executive act, which tells you just, ladies and gentlemen, oh my God, my brain wants to explode on this. I was thinking about this the other day, and then I heard about the GameStop stuff, and this just brought it home. As Joe Biden was going through and he was doing all the executive orders, I said executive acts a few moments ago, sorry about that, but he was writing all the executive orders, all I could think to myself is, the House of Representatives and Congress altogether is absolutely broken. Half of the stuff that he's doing, it's nonsense. He shouldn't be doing it through executive order. There should be legislation. These are huge, consequential projects that need legislation to get this stuff done. And the fact that Congress cannot muster itself in two weeks, put on trial Donald Trump for leading a bunch of people into the Capitol or saying that a bunch of people should go to the Capitol for insurrection. They can't do it in 2 weeks. They cannot pass a stimulus for the average American person in 2 weeks. But right now, they're mobilizing themselves literally to within the next couple of months, if not the next couple of weeks, pass legislation to restrict significantly what Reddit users are doing on the stock market. All I keep thinking as I'm watching this is what the heck happened to Rome? The elite were too insulated in their own world to understand the pain of the average person, and they didn't give two goddamns about it. Nothing. They cared nothing about the pain of the people, and that is what happened to the Roman Republic. They can't move heaven and earth to get $3 trillion out to the average person. By the way, this whole nonsense of we're giving you $1,400 on top of the $600. Seriously? By the time that money gets to people, they're talking about passing it by March. By the time that money gets to people, you're going to have hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, who have lost their places of residence. And don't give me this nonsense of moratorium bull crap. It's at the federal level. At the state level, most of these people don't have to listen to it and won't listen to it because a lot of these states don't care about what the federal government says. And by the time people get that money, which would be the end of March, the beginning of April, if they're lucky, that's going to go right out the door. $2,000 for every woman, man, and $1,000 for each child. would hold together the society, but they can't do it. But to protect a bunch of hedge funds, they can move heaven and earth to get it done. To the people in Washington, I don't even support what those people did when they stormed you, but for God's sakes, get your head out your ass. Pull your head out your bum. And do it rapidly. Because you think the discontentment is bad now? You think it's bad now? You do what you're thinking about doing. You bring the boom down on Reddit. You make it harder for average people to actually do the things that you yourself do to build your wealth. And you know what's going to happen is people will lose. Forget about faith in this society. They'll lose. They've already lost faith in you. They'll not only lose faith in the society, ladies and gentlemen, they'll lose faith in the future. And a person who does not have a future has no fear. You think people storming the Capitol is fearful? These people might actually finally see that the biggest problem is Wall Street. And the moment that happens, you don't. The French Revolution will be nothing. Stop doing what you're doing. You're driving yourself into a destiny that is not going to be favorable. Yes, yes, you got this and you got that and, you know, it's all great and everything. You know, you got people with guns. You got people who can protect you and yada, yada, yada. But that's no way to live, is it? Come on now. Get your mind together. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Brian Meredes. See you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun, or a brick, or a stone. And